This morning we're beginning a new series called On Being Human. We're going to be looking at what it means to be a human being in terms of the Bible. We're living at a very interesting time, quite a confusing time, certainly in the Western world. And we find that our mindsets are being challenged as to what is good and what is not good. There have been some progresses made in the world which are good, some things maybe not so good. But how do you define what is good and what is not good? What is progress and what is not progress? Well, it really comes down to your worldview. And this morning we want to think about worldviews. Your worldview will determine how you think of a human being before life, before birth, after birth, as you come to the last years of your life. How do you view a human being as they come near death? What's your view on marriage? What's your view on race? What's your view on equality? What's your view on sexuality? All these things are informed by your worldview. Your worldview will be shaped by your religion. It will be shaped by your parents, by your friends, by your school, by social media, by politicians. Lots of things go into shaping your worldview. In the Western world currently, many people would lead us to believe that religions are on the way out, but actually they're not, and you would find that most people in the world have some form of religion which informs the way they look at things, their worldview. In the three great monotheistic religions of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, their worldview is shaped very much by the Quran and Islamic tradition. For the Jew, their worldview will be shaped very much by the Old Testament, but also by the teaching of the rabbis and the additional teachings of the Talmud. And for the Christian, they will seek to ground their worldview on the Bible as a whole, Old Testament and New Testament, and no doubt also interpretations given by their church or their denomination about the Bible. Even the secular Westerner who has no time for religion, no time to read the Bible or the Quran or whatever, they will find that they have a worldview that is shaped by, perhaps again, their parents, perhaps by university or college, by the culture in which they live. Everyone has a worldview. And in our pluralistic, postmodern Western world, there's a further twist, because under the postmodern worldview, it states strongly that there is no such thing as absolute truth or objective truth. And we will be pushing into that worldview, actually, a bit during this series. So many beliefs today are being assumed. It's almost like a fish in water. It just accepts the water, it accepts the environment that it's in without questioning it. But we're going to question the environment that we're in. A. Keane, as he comments on culture today, says, there is an amnesia today about everything, except the immediate, the instant, the now, and the me. We don't think too much about worldviews, and especially in a postmodern world where what's true for you doesn't need to have to be true for me. Mark Sayers, in his book Disappearing Church, summarizes some of the Western liberal progressive mindset in this way. It claims that the highest good is individual freedom, happiness, self-definition, and self-expression. Thus, traditions, religions, received wisdom, regulations, and social ties must be reshaped, deconstructed, or even destroyed. The world, according to this worldview, will inevitably improve as the scope of individual freedom grows. Technology, in particular the internet, will motor this progression towards utopia. What I want to do in this series is to argue that the Christian worldview, as we have it in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, and as lived out by Jesus of Nazareth, is actually the best worldview. That's what I'm going to be arguing. And as we seek to discern what the Bible says on being human, we're going to be looking at a lot of very difficult and controversial issues and subjects, everything to do with life and death and emotions and sexuality and so on. So the series is going to be stretching. It's going to be challenging. It will perhaps be controversial in parts. The sermons are going to be longer. So if you want to bring a picnic, that's okay. But it is very important that we look at this together. This morning, we're going to be looking very briefly at Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And I want to see from Genesis four basic aspects of the Christian worldview. I want to, if you like, form a grid or a matrix that we can place over every issue that we come up against, and to say, well, this is the Christian matrix that we place over this issue and what it means to be a human being. And it's essentially going to focus on relationships. First of all, our relationship with God, our relationship with each other, our relationship with the earth, and then finally to see our relationships as broken. So let's look at each of those in turn, and as I say, we get these from Genesis. So first of all, in Genesis 1, 26a, we read, God said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness. Human beings, first of all, are made in the image of God, and they are created with the capacity to be like God, to have a relationship with Him, to converse with Him in that respect, to relate to Him. And this is where we are different from the rest of the created kingdom. God breathes His Spirit into men and women, and He gives them the capacity to love, to hate, to choose, to think, to rationalize, to debate, to plan. So to be made in the image of God, it doesn't necessarily mean that we look like God, because God is Spirit, but it means we have this ability to do, we have the capacity to do these things. And that is what makes us unique as human beings. We're often told by evolutionists and educationalists that we share something like 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. And from this, they deduce that we have therefore evolved from chimpanzees. Although I would have an issue with that, because I would argue, well, why do we still have chimpanzees if we have evolved from chimpanzees? No, I think the point of us being 98% same DNA with chimps and apes and so on is that we are made of the same stuff as the rest of creation. We are made, as it were, from the same dust. But the difference is that God has breathed His Spirit into human beings and given them a capacity to worship, a capacity to argue, a capacity to rationalize, a capacity to debate, to write books, to make films, to compose music. This is what makes the difference. You may be aware of an organization called PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And a little slogan sometimes that PETA will use is that a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. And what they're trying to do with that slogan is to say, basically, we are all not only made from the same stuff, but we are all equal. A rat and a pig and a dog and a boy are equal. And there is truth here, because we are equal in the sense that we are all created. We are all made from the same stuff. And that, in a sense, is what Genesis will say. But there's another equally important point, which is that we are made in the image of God, that human beings are made in God's image. And so if we emphasize one part of the grid over another part of the grid, we can end up a bit askew. So that's the first point in terms of this matrix of what is a human being, what is the worldview. We're made in the image of God. And the second thing that Genesis would establish is that as human beings, we not only relate to God, but as relational creatures, we are made to relate to one another. Genesis 2 and 18 says, "It is not good for the man to be alone." Now, of course, we use this very much within the context of marriage. It is not good for the man or woman to be alone. But I think it has much wider applications in terms of what we are as human beings, that we were made to be sociable creatures. We were made to relate to one another, be close to one another. We are made for relationship on this kind of horizontal level. In January 2018, the United Kingdom government, as the result of a report from the Joe Cox Commission on Loneliness, reported that more than 9 million people in Britain, around 14% of the population, often or always feel lonely. And in January 2018, they appointed a minister for loneliness, Tracy Crouch, and this is a picture of her. She's actually been replaced recently by Mims Davis. Stuart Dicker's writing in the Guardian newspaper, not the Ballymena Guardian, the other Guardian. It's a long quotation, but I think he sums up a lot of what's going on here. He says, "Loneliness is an indiscriminate disease that has become an epidemic. There are some obvious pathogens, the deconstruction of community, the conversion of a citizen into a consumer, and the politics of envy. We are no longer bowling together, and family life has been unraveling for some time now. Since the 1980s, we've been gaining comfort from consumer materialism and convenience in exchange for our identity. The public square has become privatized, and we have lived individual, unconnected lives behind locked doors in gated estates as we gorge on delivered groceries, box sets, and now just eat takeaways. We have been slowly losing touch with each other and with reality. The latest strain is a digital virus, detectable only to the analog eye of our pre-electronic generation. It is demolishing real sociability and replacing it with virtual reality. A techie elite has hijacked the narrative, causing a quantum shift in human interaction. This threatens the human genius of community, which has been the primary driver in the species' journey from family to gang to clan to tribe to nation to federation." And that very wordy quote with some quite big words in it is more or less saying that we are made for each other. We are made to be sociable creatures. We relate to God. That's part of what it means to be a human being. But we also relate horizontally to each other. And that is absolutely necessary. It is a fundamental part of what it means to be a human being. And there are certainly even aspects of this also in the animal world as well. It's not necessarily unique to human beings, but it reaches its apex. It reaches the pinnacle with human beings. It is not good for man to be alone. Thirdly, then, we see in this matrix, in this grid that we get from Genesis, the Genesis shares with us in Genesis 1:26b and 28 to verse 30, that human beings are made to have dominion. We're made to have a relationship with the earth and the rest of creation. Yes, we're made with the capacity to worship God, we're made with the capacity to relate to others, but we're also made with the capacity to have dominion over the created order, over the earth. Now, of course, today this is becoming very much front and center in the news. A couple of weeks ago, we heard about an organization called Extinction Rebellion. These are the guys who are gluing themselves to each other and gluing themselves to buildings and so on to protest, to say we need to do more as a government, we need to do more as individuals to protect our environment. For many years and decades, the Christian church has been behind the door in terms of environment. And yet, is that the way it should be? I would argue, actually, that we should be more concerned about the environment than your average person, because this is our Father's world. It's Dad's place. He has given it to us. And he says, I want you to steward this. I want you to rule over it. I want you to care for it. Because he has given it to us as the tenants, as the stewards. So within the Christian worldview, there is a strong aspect of how we subdue, how we care, how we nurture, how we respect the earth of which we are part. And this is the third part of this matrix that we are presented with in Genesis. A relationship with God, a relationship with each other, and a relationship with the earth upon which we live. And then the fourth part of this matrix, which we get as we move into Genesis chapter 3, is that we are broken. Our relationship, each of these relationships is broken according to Genesis chapter 3. So our relationship with God is broken. Our relationship with each other has got this brokenness in it. And our relationship with the earth has also been broken. And Paul in Romans chapter 8 speaks of the groaning of creation, the aching and the groaning and the breaking of creation, and that will one day be restored, but there's a fallenness that impacts all our relationships. The fallenness impacts our worship of God and our obedience of God, and that means, the outworking of sin means, is that we will rather worship ourselves than worship God. And that's often put in the sort of way that in cremations today in England, the most popular song sung at funerals is still Sinatra's My Way, because people feel this kind of sums me up. You know, I did it my way. That's the prominent message that they want to get across. In Genesis 3, it says we're fallen in our relationship with God. But we're not only fallen in our relationship with God, we're fallen in our relationship with each other. Every single person in this room has some form of brokenness. It may be mental brokenness or emotional brokenness or physical brokenness or sexual brokenness. Every single person, there's not a family or a household that doesn't have some form of brokenness within it. And that is a reminder to us that we need to be gentle with each other because we come as broken people to God. And he encourages us to be gentle with one another. Rico Tice says, we are more sinful than we ever realized, but we are more loved in Jesus than we ever dreamed. There are various ways that brokenness is working through our society, and we're going to be looking at those as we go through this series. But I want to argue, as we look at those, we place this grid over them, and try and make sense of what is happening in this world. And I would argue that this Christian worldview makes best sense of what we encounter today. But we cannot stop there because there's a fifth part of the grid. There's a fifth part of the matrix that we need to make even more sense from a Christian worldview. And that fifth part of the matrix is that Jesus has come. And Jesus is the perfect human being, and he is the redeemer of each of these other four relationships. So Jesus came to show us what it was to be a perfect human being in perfect obedience to his heavenly Father. He came to show us in a perfect way what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. He came to show us what it means to relate to the earth and the world and have control and rule over the created order. Jesus is perfect. Tim Keller says, echoing what I said earlier from Rico Tice, we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe, yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. In Jesus, we see the perfect human being who not only showed us how to live the perfect human life, but more than this, he took my brokenness and he took your brokenness and it was placed on his shoulders And that pain and that punishment and that penalty and that brokenness, he took away. He paid the price for our sin and our brokenness. And this morning, as we come in a moment to this table, we come to this sacrament of communion, which reminds us that each of these elements are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. God, through Jesus, has given us this sacrament, this table. So the vertical relationship is emphasized. I'm giving you this table to remember that I have healed the divide between God and humanity. It has now been healed in Christ, so he gives us this sacrament. At a table, we not only remember the presence of God is here, but we remember the presence of everyone around the table. Tables are great because in terms of human interaction, the table is the best place to be present to one another. If you want to really get to know someone, if you really want to build a relationship with someone, well, then you invite them to dinner or lunch or whatever, and you get around the table and you interact, and it's a way in which you engage, you are present, you are fully present to each other, and that is important. I was reading last week about a restaurant in Leamington Spa that has a notice on the front door of the restaurant. It bans customers from bringing their mobile phones into the restaurant. And this is what Darren Yates, who's the head chef, told the Independent newspaper. The psychology behind it is that for 2 hours, when having a meal and breaking bread, that's an interesting phrase he uses, breaking bread, the focus should be on conversation. Mealtime is the most important time for a family to get together and to chat about how their day has been and not to be on their phone. Now, we have a little rule in our house that you don't bring your phone to the table, and if someone does bring the phone to the table and it goes off and a text comes in, they have to read the text to the rest of the table. Today, as we become present to God and as we become present to each other around this table, if I see you with a mobile phone, I'll be coming down and asking you to read the text out to everybody else. Because we are present to one another, not to someone who's not here, no, present to one another. We are family together. So Jesus has given us this lovely sacrament, which speaks of being present to God, being present to one another. And the beauty of it is, he has given us some of the most basic elements. He's given us bread and juice, the most basic elements of creation. So I want you to remember the spiritual truths of what I have done for you. I want you to remember those truths. So these very simple, basic elements of bread, the most staple diet of a human being, bread, and wine or juice. So we remember spiritual truths through a physical, created stuff. That is the brilliance of Jesus. So in relationship, Jesus says, we at this table, we remember we have a relationship with God, we are present to God, we're present to each other, we are present to the creation. I'm giving you bread and wine to remind you that you are attached, you are affixed to the creation. Your body is good, it's part of the created order, it's good to eat and drink. And God, through Jesus Christ, has even redeemed the creation. So this is the grid, this is the matrix, as it were. This is our worldview. It's all in Genesis. And I would contest, and we will see this as we go through these weeks, that each of these five parts of the grid, as we place them on the issues that we will be dealing with, I would contend that we have the best worldview, the most hopeful worldview in each of the issues we will face.